from KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barrett. Coming up this week, one man has an idea why the Bristol Bay sockeye season came up so short this year. A new study shows frankenfish can breed with wild salmon if they get loose. And what if the charter halibut fleet could buy commercial halibut quota? All that and more coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The sockeye salmon run to Bristol Bay this year has come in well below the preseason forecast. The difference between the actual run and the forecast could be up to 10 million fish. Some research published in April might shed some light about why. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Back in April, an article was published in the Journal of Marine Science that examined the implications of a warming eastern Bering Sea on Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. One of the lead researchers was Ed Farley with the National Marine Fisheries Service's Alaska Fisheries Science Center. He's the program manager for the Ecosystem Monitoring Assessment Program. He says the latest research builds on a larger research effort that started back in 1999.
And the reason that we're doing, we're focusing on the first year in the ocean is because that's a really critical period when fish or salmon leave fresh water. They enter the marine environment. Of course, they're going from fresh water into salt water, so they're making osmoregulatory changes and dealing with that, and then also dealing with a number of new predators that they're going to be experiencing, and then also finding food resources.
Much of the data in the new research comes from surveys conducted from mid-August to September from the inner Bristol Bay area out to the Pribilof Islands. Farley says his research was aided by samples collected by Russian researchers in the North Pacific, south of the Aleutian Islands. The fitness of sockeye is apparently connected to their size, and one of the factors that impacts that size is the condition of the ocean, which can impact migration patterns and the amount and the size of the prey available. Farley says that from 1999 to 2010, there have been a couple of major climate events in the Bering Sea that have impacted Bristol Bay sockeye.
We've experienced two different ocean conditions or climate events. One in 2000 and 2001, where it was kind of average conditions in terms of, if you look back historically at sea temperature in the Bering Sea. Then in 2002 and 3 and 4 and 5, we had a real warming event, and we saw some real changes in the ecosystem as a response. And those warming conditions tended to favor juvenile salmon abundance. We saw lots of fish out there. In other words, that those fish that left fresh water had some pretty high survival. That was a good index, because I think if you would know that the runs have been pretty strong after that event.
Starting in 2006, Farley says the data showed a cooling trend in the Bering Sea that resulted in some significant changes in the ocean environment that has, and likely still is, impacting the run of sockeye back to Bristol Bay.
The cold conditions have persisted into 9 and 10. And our survey has actually shown that we've started to see a decline in the catch per unit effort. And I just was looking over at the Bristol Bay catch records this year, and it looks like they had a forecast of 38 million, and I noticed there's about 26 million so far. We don't know what it means yet, but the 2008, 2009, 2010, those years would be the years that, because sockeye salmon spend 2 to 3 years in the ocean. Those would be the years that would be returning right now.
If the survival of Bristol Bay's juvenile sockeye salmon is directly associated to specific ocean conditions, that might be another data point that could be used to develop more accurate forecasts for the return of adult sockeye to the inshore commercial fishing districts in Bristol Bay. The research about the implication of a warming eastern Bering Sea for Bristol Bay sockeye salmon was published in April in the Journal of Marine Sciences. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A new study of genetically modified salmon show they can breed with their wild counterparts. That raises concerns that the escaped farm fish could weaken wild stocks. It's not an immediate threat to Alaska species, though it could be to commercial sales. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The study was conducted at the Memorial University of Newfoundland on Canada's eastern seaboard. Graduate student Derek Moreau says he and other researchers work with what are called growth hormone transgenic Atlantic salmon. Those have an added Chinook or king salmon gene that speeds their growth. Moreau says modified males were exposed to male and female wild salmon in a laboratory simulation of natural spawning conditions.
Well, we found that the transgenics had a much reduced breeding performance, but they did in fact show an interest in breeding. and the ability to breed.
The research, published in the scientific journal Evolutionary Application, is the first to show this type of genetically engineered salmon can interbreed with wild fish. Moreau says the study should raise concerns about the possible release of modified salmon through accidents at fish farms.
If there was a significant number of V-scapes that occurred in succession over many years, there's certainly the potential for there to be some harm.
He notes that the commercial developer, Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounties Technologies, plans to raise only sterile fish in closed pens. The company did not return calls requesting comment, but it has not begun commercial production. British Columbia has the closest fish farms to Alaska. Past accidents have released Atlantic salmon into the Pacific Ocean, some of which ended up in Alaska waters. But several scientists say cross-fertilization is not an issue here.
Atlantic salmon basically don't breed with Pacific salmon.
Ted Myers is chief pathologist for Alaska's Department of Fish and Game.
As far as being a genetic threat to our own Pacific salmon here in Southeast, that's not likely. Speaking in that term, the transgenic fish then would be no greater threat than the unaltered Atlantic salmon currently farmed in BC.
And that province's fish farms say they don't plan to use the modified fish anytime soon. Ruth Salmon is executive director of the Canadian Aquaculture Industry Alliance, which includes the British Columbia Salmon Farmers Association. She says the industry is waiting for government assurance that the fish are safe.
That's a key component. But the other aspect here is until the market demands it, because we're producing products that the market demands. And right now, there is no demand for GMO salmon.
Fish farm critics say that time will come. Alexandra Morton is a marine biologist in British Columbia and a leading critic of fish farming's impacts on wild salmon runs.
One thing they tell us all the time is that they have to remain competitive, and that's why if genetically modified fish give one area an edge on the market, in other words, make these fish grow faster, then you can be sure they're going to be wanting to use it here just as soon as possible.
Morton says modified salmon, like their unaltered cousins, could spread disease and parasites to wild Pacific stock. And she says commercial development should be limited. Researcher Derek Moreau, who proved the fish could crossbreed with wild Atlantic salmon, has fewer concerns. But he says containment is the key to safety.
So long as these animals are treated with respect and raised in a manner that respects the potential danger that they could cause to ecosystems, I don't think Alaskans need to worry too much about this technology from an environmental perspective.
It could raise concerns from an economic perspective. Faster growth would improve the competitive advantage of farmed fish, which have already displaced wild salmon sales worldwide. Alaska's congressional delegation and about 20 other members of Congress recently wrote the Food and Drug Administration to oppose Aqua Bounty's plans. One letter said sales of genetically modified salmon would cause fear and confusion among consumers, and that could slow all sales of the species. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Pebble Partnership, pursuing jobs and opportunities for Southwest Alaska. Find out more at pebblepartnership.com.
And by
the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
A Trident Seafood tender ran aground on Catherine Island in Chatham Strait Tuesday morning. The 100-foot Oregon is based out of Seattle. The boat was anchored and in the process of doing a fish transfer when the tide went out, leaving it on shore. The Coast Guard says the depth sounder on board malfunctioned. The Oregon was refloated during the afternoon tide. All five crew remained on board along with 250,000 pounds of fish and 6,000 gallons of diesel fuel. The grounding did not result in any pollution. Alaska's charter fishing industry is attempting to come up with a plan that would allow charter operators to purchase halibut quota from the commercial fishing fleet. Jeff Salzer is the project manager for the Accountability Through Compensated Halibut, or CATCH, project.
The CATCH project is funded by National Fish and Wildlife Foundation's Fisheries Innovation Grant. And what we've been granted to do is to take a look at the feasibility of developing an industry-supported CATCH share plan, which is a pooled CATCH share plan, with two elements in there that would include the purchase of allocation, or IFQ, from the commercial sector into the recreational sector. And then the second aspect of that is to look at the feasibility of different measures of accountability within the charter industry to maintain harvest limits.
The Catch Project is also being funded through in-kind donations from the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization and the Alaska Charter Association. Concerns over dwindling halibut stocks have led the federal government to slash commercial catch limits while also implementing much stricter regulations for the charter fleet. The commercial catch limit in Southeast is 73% lower than it was 8 years ago. In an effort to rein in the charter catch, the feds implemented a one halibut per day rule for charter customers 2 years ago. This year, the federal government took further steps to curtail the charter catch, implementing a limited entry system for charter operators and a 37-inch limit on charter-caught halibut in Southeast. Salzer says the size limit has been highly controversial within the charter fleet, but admits it's been effective in keeping charter catches within federal guideline harvest levels.
This is designed to create a specific result, and unfortunately, I think it's extremely efficient at creating that result, but it's a result that isn't, you know, good for business. And I think that, you know, as an industry, and if we can work together and talk with, you know, get both sides of the table to sit down, we can find solutions as an industry that make a lot more sense, that can achieve similar results. Because at the end of the day, it's about managing a resource that people depend on and their livelihoods depend on.
Salzer says the Catch Project is conducting listening sessions this month throughout Southeast and South Central. He says the hope is to collect ideas for a proposal that would eventually be presented to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
We're going to get people's opinions and ideas on a couple different functions. But when you think about it, the two things have to happen. And one is there needs to be accountability. And how do we maintain accountability is we have to know where we're at during the season. So how do we collect data that's timely enough that can be utilized? The second part of that is then, of course, with the pooled catch share and the compensated, the purchase of the IFQ, you know, how is that going to be handled? How's that going to be funded? How are we going to, you know, manage that? Is it going to be an RFA? Is it going to be something different than that? And that's sort of what we'll do when we go back as we take some of these ideas and put that together.
Salzer expects a draft plan will be released this fall. Juneau Lodge owner Richard Yamada is working as a technical advisor on the Catch Project. He believes the charter and commercial fleets could come to some consensus since both sides stand to benefit from the project.
There's something to be gained from the commercial side, and really the catch accountability is a big item and something that, you know, the charter sector is going to have to wrestle with as well. But also for the charter side is the purchase mechanism to be able to buy quota share and alleviate some of the restrictions like these size limits. That in the long term is a, you know, something that is a need that the charter sector is seeking. There's something there to be gained by both sides, and I think we just need to kind of flesh that out and start talking.
A calendar of catch meetings can be found on the organization's website, catchalaska.org.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, KFSK's Esme Joyce in Petersburg, KRBD's Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and KDLG's Mike Mason in Dillingham. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.